This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of AXL. AXL is the American College of Cardiology Extended Learning Series, featuring conversations in cardiology with the scientists who conduct research in our field and the clinicians who are translating that research into clinical practice. You are about to hear an interview from our latest issue. As an AXL subscriber, you will receive 24 new interviews each month. Plus, depending on your subscription level, we'll have access to hundreds of interviews in our digital library. With AXL, you can stream or download your content for convenient offline access on your mobile device, and each interview qualifies for CME credit and MOC self-assessment points. For more information, visit acc.org/ACCEL.
Listen now to a talk Benjamin Sureka had with Dr. Tom Ford of the University of Glasgow in the UK. They cover endothelial dysfunction and altered peripheral vascular reactivity in patients with angina and non-obstructive coronary artery disease.
Tom, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
So this has been a real remarkable field over the last 10 years or so with the recognition of non-obstructive disease, but evidence of symptomatic as well as microcirculatory problems. And I wonder if you could just start and give a little bit of the physiologic basis that we think is going on now in these types of patients.
Sure, no problem. Well, I think this is, as you say, a very interesting area. So these were patients who have definite angina based on validated Rose angina questionnaire. But interestingly, when we perform the invasive angiogram, there is no obstructive epicardial disease that would be responsible for their symptoms. And that's categorized by less than 50% diameter stenosis, but we also confirm that with physiology. So we use the tool that you'll be familiar with, the fractional flow reserve, FFR, to exclude significant obstructive lesions. So as part of this study, we performed physiological interrogation of two different metrics of the coronary artery function. And it's really of note that the international community has got together with a working group, which is called COVADIS. And they have standardized the criteria for diagnosing microvascular angina. But in the last year, they've also standardized the diagnostic criteria for vasospastic angina.
And what are those criteria?
Yeah, so it's an interesting point. The criteria for diagnosing microvascular angina requires symptoms consistent with angina, and that doesn't necessarily mean chest pain. The patients would have to have unobstructed arteries, and then they have to have invasive evidence of coronary microvascular dysfunction.
And how are you detecting that in the lab?
What we do is we use a guiding catheter. We introduce a physiological pressure wire into the artery, typically the LAD, as it subtends the largest myocardial mass. We then exclude obstructive disease using the FFR, and briefly, using thermodilution, we can assess the transit time of a bolus of saline at rest, and we use an average of 3 beats. So it's very similar to performing a right heart cath and measuring the pulmonary transit times through that circulation. So we perform thermodilution to assess the coronary flow reserve. Just to remind you, the coronary flow reserve is just a ratio of the maximum achievable flow in that artery divided by the resting flow. And in our study, we used a cutoff of 2, less than 2 as being indicative of a reduced flow reserve. But the criteria are a bit more diverse than that. They also include a parameter called the microcirculatory resistance.
And what's that?
So the IMR was a tool devised in California, actually, with Bill Fearon and Martin Ng, who's been one of our collaborators. So they basically devise this tool, which is a really reproducible, quite easy to perform. You use adenosine to induce hyperemia, and then you measure the transit time of 3 mL bolus of saline down the artery. And again, we take an average, say the transit time might be, for example, half a second down the artery. And we would times that by the mean distal pressure in the artery at hyperemia. So what that basically means is it's a reproducible measure of the microcirculatory resistance, and it correlates with microvascular dysfunction.
And how much can you modulate that with drugs like nitroglycerin or calcium antagonists?
So typically, the measurements are performed after we have given GTN. And the IMR is not something that we think changes much acutely with medications. But certainly, there's been some experimental work done coming out of Bill Fearon's group in transplant patients using ACE inhibitors and statins. And they've shown, I believe, in the transplant population, the ACE inhibitors do, in fact, on a longitudinal follow-up, can improve microvascular dysfunction.
That's great. So that's for the microvascular circulation. For the vasospastic, how did you determine that?
So we use acetylcholine. So the two probes, adenosine for the IMR, the CFR, but acetylcholine, which we give in a slow infusion. And with the slow infusion, helps us to assess the microcirculation. And it's basically looking to see an excitable microcirculation that might go down into spasm. The next part of the acetylcholine test looks at a different disorder. That's looking at epicardial smooth muscle spasm. And that requires a bolus of acetylcholine. So quite distinct from the slow infusion, we would typically give a bolus of acetylcholine, and we're looking to see reproduction of their typical symptoms, a greater than 90% reduction in luminal diameter. So to us interventional cardiologists, that's basically an occlusion of the artery with ST changes. So these are strict criteria, but those are the three things which form the consensus definition for diagnosing vasospastic angina in the cath lab.
So you took your patients who had ANOCA. How did it break down in terms of the different categories?
So it's a very interesting question. So some of that data is yet to be presented and is under embargo, but the study that we presented today, we have 81 patients that participated in this vascular biology substudy. So very interesting. We found 59 of these patients to have microvascular angina, 11 had vasospastic angina, and 11 had entirely normal microvascular function. So really quite a strikingly low proportion of patients with entirely normal microvascular dysfunction.
And how did those coronary results correlate with peripheral vascular reactivity now?
It's a great question. So this study that we performed wasn't so much looking at the correlation of the two, and that analysis has been done before. But what we did, which was different, was to look at the maximum vasorelaxation of the small peripheral arteries. And what we've been able to show, and I think provides really quite conclusive evidence, that these patients do actually have endothelial dysfunction. So that's the microvascular angina cohort had impaired vasorelaxation to ACH, consistent with endothelial impairment. But what was really interesting was that the vasospastic patients similarly had endothelial dysfunction compared to the control subjects.
And so your conclusion from that is?
Well, I think endothelial dysfunction is a really important early target marker of peripheral vascular dysfunction. And we know that it has prognostic implications as well as potentially treatment implications for our patients. So the really important message, I guess, is we're looking after patients with microvascular angina. They've got non-obstructive disease. Well, if we can offer them a diagnosis, I think that's important. But our study today really, I would hope, would emphasize the importance of looking at their overall cardiovascular risk. And that means adopting important healthy lifestyle measures as well as potential consideration of therapies that we know improve the endothelial function. And that would require potentially a bigger trial, but things like ACE inhibitors and statins.
And the physiology is just fascinating. Can you achieve any assessment of microcirculation of the heart with non-invasive imaging?
That's right. So there's definitely a number of ways in which you can assess things like coronary flow reserve non-invasively. I guess for us as interventional cardiologists, we would see these patients often in the cath lab. And I would like to make an argument that we've already subjected them to an arterial peripheral access. So it's not too much additional work to perform what we would term an interventional diagnostic procedure to assess their microvascular impairment. And I think our patients deserve that. They've come to us with symptoms and we need to try and help them to explain them. And that may have an influence on their compliance with therapy and patient-related outcomes.
I think you're exactly right, especially if you're in a lab that's doing really these testing at the forefront of the practice. I think more commonly I send my patients and I'm told they don't have any lesions, they still have symptoms in my office. And so being able to do some assessment without sending them back to the lab would obviously help, because the last thing you want to do is not treat them
exactly
with the therapies that we think would benefit and need testing.
So I guess maybe non-invasive tools to confirm the diagnosis. If you're in a specialist center, we use cardiac stress myocardial perfusion. But again, we still, and this is a really important area for research, we don't know the correlation of these invasive markers that their microcirculation is unhealthy and metrics on the MRI. We can also do coronary flow reserve testing using echo, stress echo. But again, the reliability and reproducibility of that technique has been questioned by some. But I think that patients do deserve a diagnosis, and you're right, is that often they would come back with normal coronaries, and the question is, you know, what's the cause of their symptoms?
It is, but I think you're helping to shed light into this, what I believe is a quite a common condition. So thanks so much for coming to Axel.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. And thanks to my supervisor, Professor Colin Berry.
This is Alfred Beauvais, Editor-in-Chief of Axel, and you've been listening to an interview from our recent issue. For more information on how to subscribe to Axel and receive additional interviews published each month, go to acc.org/accel.